Welcome to Launch, where we explore the world of invention and entrepreneurship. I'm Jim DeBetta with my co-host Ron Reardon and our producer Lee Cantor. Good morning, guys.
Hello, Jim.
Hello, Jim. How are you doing today?
Jim is doing great. Ron, how are you today?
I'm doing super fine.
And Lee?
I'm okay.
Good. Now that we got that out of the way. Last week, we had a great show. We talked about the patent process and why you need to do a patent search. And Ron had some great stories about some products out there. And we talked about validating your idea by doing some consumer surveys or focus groups. Ron, I think we know what's next in the process, or at least what people have to
start thinking. Oh, so you're not done there? Just when you validate it, you're not on your way to riches yet?
You've made millions already. That's it.
There's more to this.
Yeah, because most inventors say, I've got an idea, and I don't want to do any of the heavy lifting. I just want to sell the idea to a company.
Yeah.
Do they say that? Is that true?
Over and over again, yes.
So they just want a check for their idea.
Yes.
Does that ever happen?
No.
In a million years, have you heard of one story where some guy goes, hey, look at this three-sentence idea I have. Someone's going to write me a check on that?
Actually, I have heard it happening once, and it's because the fellow was a professional inventor. He invented on demand by very big companies, had a tremendous success record, actually went to one of his previous clients and says, I have an idea for this. And the fellow, the president says, how much money do you need? He says, $20,000, wrote him the check, and off he went.
Have you, Jim, heard of that story?
I've not heard that. I've not ever heard of anybody just purely selling an idea in their mind without anything, so to speak, on paper.
Wow.
Yeah. It's an anomaly.
So that's a myth.
It is definitely a myth.
It's an inventor myth.
Companies do not buy ideas. They buy selling products.
That's the key. It's got to be something tangible in front of you, or at least you have to have some patent protection. You have to have a patent or something that
makes it real. So a patent makes it real because now you can protect that. That's something that could exist.
Well, a patent doesn't make the actual idea into a product. The patent gives you the right to be able to market that product without fear of infringing on somebody else.
Yeah, once you have an issued patent right from the government, then you've got the right to prohibit other people from making, using, selling, or importing the product that's protected in the claims.
So the magic is, okay, you've got that right. Now you got to do something with it.
And that's what we're going to talk about today, right? We're going to take this idea that we've all vetted, and now we've talked to our mom. She said it was great, which we knew she would. And then we did some research, and then it's viable. It seems to be viable. Check the patent. We could get a patent if we wanted to. Now we move down the road, right?
Yeah, I think that the next obvious step is when people come to me at the stage where they've done the patent work, they've done the validation, so to speak, they will say, Jim, I want to send you a sample. I want you to take a look at it. And often they'll think that the sample that they've sent or the prototype is perfect, but in fact, it's not always perfect.
So this sample could be like duct tape and, a box, and that's their sample? Is this something like that they've had a professional create and model? And
It all of the above.
Could be anything.
All of the above.
One associate of mine out in Colorado, a doctor came to her. He'd come up with a very neat device for putting bicycles on tops of cars. He had patents on it. He had a device manufactured. He came into her and says, okay, I'm ready to get this thing marketed. She looked at it, says, you're going to have to get new patents because we're going to have to totally change this design in order to get the cost where they should be and so that it will fit together. And he had to start over, which he was kind of angry at the beginning. But then he went back and followed her directions, and now it's selling very, very well, protected by different patents.
Well, that's awesome. I mean, sometimes you hear all kinds of stories with people, the paths they take. But the thing that they have to do once they get that prototype or that sample made, whether they have it handmade themselves or they have somebody local do it, is they've got to make sure that the product that they want to bring to market will actually work the way
they'd like it to, right.
And that's important because, again, you could have something in your hands, and I could say, well, it looks good, but if it's something that's got some moving parts or it's got electricity rolling through it, or even if it's something simple, I'm not an expert at the actual prototyping and design. I'm not an engineer. So seeking out a design firm or an engineering firm that makes consumer products, to me, is the very next step to make sure that the product can actually be made right.
And then we're also, really another element of it that they have to think about is how is this going to stack on the shelf, right?
Bingo.
So, like, you can have a great product, but if it's super bulky and odd-shaped, they may not be able to put it in boxes to ship. I mean, it affects a bunch of different things, right?
And that was part of the challenge with this bicycle idea that I was talking about earlier, is that it would not condense down to a very small package. It was really big and bulky when it's packaged. Mm-hmm. And that was the redesign that had to be done, was so that it would fit into a very small box that could be shipped and stored and all like that.
Now, I'm not sure what the percentage of products that go in front of a design or engineering firm actually get changed, but I know there's some conflicts with patents, because you can have your idea and have filed a patent for it, and then some people, some inventors will say, well, what happens if it goes in front of an engineer and they really change the product? How does that affect my patent status?
Yeah, and a lot of times it means you got to do another patent, and that's why the timing of when you file the patent application is very, very important. Is that if it's just an idea on a napkin, that's not when you want to send in what we call a non-provisional patent application, because you really need to know this is what we're going to market with and protect that.
Right.
You know, where people spend a lot of money the wrong way in this business for inventors is they do things without getting the information, and then they spend lots of money, and then they have to go back and do it over and over again. And finally, unfortunately, they learn the hard way by spending money. So that's...
Yeah, because, I mean, if you look at individual inventors, I mean, number one, the odds of an individual inventor getting their product successfully in the marketplace is pretty slim, depending on which source you look at. It's somewhere between 1 in 100 and 1 in 1,000 probability that an individual inventor can get a product into the marketplace.
And that's not even determining if it's going to be successful. That's just to put it in the marketplace to have a chance to be successful?
No, that's to be successfully in the marketplace, you got between 1 in 100 and 1 in 1,000 chance. Because even the big guys, statistics I saw on 3M indicated that 32% of their products were successful. That means that 68% of their products tanked. And that's 3M, okay?
And that's like baseball.
Yeah. I mean, if you hit 300, you're doing
okay. You know?
But I wish more inventors would have those kind of percentages like a 3M does. And I think that they could have much better odds if they went through the process correctly. They seem to skip the step. They get excited about making money, and they forget to do all the basics.
So they want to take a shortcut? Is that what they do?
Right. Well, either that or they're trying to do it alone. When you look at individual inventors, there's basically four elements that contribute to an individual inventor's success. First, they have to have the good idea.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then they need to have a very thorough plan on how they're going to be going to market. And they need a team, the right team of people, to help them with that plan, and then they need adequate funding.
Right.
They need to have all four of those elements. And what a lot of inventors will leave out is that team of enlisting the resources of folks that have been down this path. They know the elements. They know where the mines are, and that can help them.
I mean, what's that old saying, you don't know what you don't know, or something like that, where, you know, people, they don't know what to do, but they just go ahead and try to figure it out. And
is there, like, where could they get this information? Where, you know, there's so many scammy things out there. Where's, like, the good place to go to get this kind of magic list?
Well, I mean, there's a one non-for-profit association in this business called the United Inventors Association, or the UIA, and mm-hmm. you could find them at, I think, Ron, is it UIA.org or just
we got both org and .com, UIAUSA.com or UIAUSA.org.
And you'll see a list of trusted, tested, or time-tested people in the business, from patent agents like Ron to sales and marketing experts like myself and a lot of other of our colleagues in this industry that can be trusted to help people go through the process correctly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because what I tell people is, if you see a company on TV, don't go there.
That's a red flag.
Their success rate's pretty slim.
So the TV show I had planned is
that's out.
Don't do that.
All right, we'll stick to radio. I think it's a lot more fun. But, you know, Lee and Ron, I think the big thing that people have to understand, Ron keeps saying it over and over, and I want to emphasize it, is seeking out help when you need help. There are a lot of inventors who are smart. They have done their research. They know what to do. But if you don't know what you don't know, find help, because it's only going to cost you money later on.
Right. Yeah. Years ago, Inventor's Digest came out with 10 commandments of inventing. And I always like commandment number 9, because commandment number 9 says, do what you do best and hire professionals to do the rest.
Oh, so it's a rhyme, like the 10 rhyming commandments of inventing.
If only Moses had thought of that.
All right. What's number 5? Do you know what number 5 is?
No, I have no idea.
What's number 1? I don't know what number 1 is, you know, but... It's fun. It's a funny business, Lee, because the odds of success are tough. I mean, I tell people all the time, it's not an easy business, because it's a very competitive business.
Sure. Now, we were talking last week about the idea, and today we're going to talk a little bit more about the manufacturing process. Can we get back on that? Like, what you have your idea? What do you do next?
Well, you have to get in front of either an engineer or a design firm that can look at your product. So, for example, if I came up with an idea and I have the product, and whether I use duct tape and glue to put it together, or I actually had...
So now you have a sample of some... Is that a prototype?
A prototype.
Is that what it's called?
Right, a prototype. So it may be working, it may not be working, but it's some form of what the product's going to be. But you got to have a professional look at it, because when you go to have something manufactured by a factory, you got to make sure it could be done at all, number one. Just because you have an idea and you have a prototype doesn't necessarily mean it could be mass-produced. And you got to also make sure it could be mass-produced for the right price, so that it could be sold at retail effectively.
Yeah, because your invention has got to, when the design firm looks at it, they got to look at it for several different dimensions. Is number one, can it be manufactured inexpensively?
Right.
You know, and number two, can it be manufactured so that, you know, when it's packed up, okay, it you know, takes up very little space, you know, either in the warehouse or on the shelves. And then number three, I had a number three, if I can remember it. Can it be manufactured such that it can be assembled, you know, at a very low cost?
Right.
I mean, if it takes, you know, building a $1 million machine to assemble it, that's not good.
Right.
But if it's something that can be assembled, you know, manually or whatever, then that's a different story.
You know, the process of manufacturing is a big source of concern for a lot of inventors. It's one of the areas, it's kind of like patents, where people just don't quite understand it, and they don't understand that it's a long process. And dealing with factories, especially if they're overseas, there are barriers.
Yeah, there's language barriers, there's time barriers, and communication barriers.
Is there a rule of thumb of if a product is manufactured to cost X, then it retails for, you know, five times X or three times or whatever it is?
That's not bad, not badly. Pretty good. There are some rules of thumb. A lot of people live by these rules, but I don't know, in today's retail, it really depends on what the retailer is looking for in terms of margin. I'll get back to that in a minute. But if you make something for a dollar, or cost you a dollar to have it made by a factory, and that would also include the cost of, say, getting it over to your warehouse. So let's say now it's $2 all in. The product's made, packaged, it's at your warehouse. The retailer's typically going to want to double their money, or what's called keystoning. If they buy it for $4, you get it made for $2. You charge them $4, they're going to sell it for at least $8. That's a typical scenario, but the difference between the $2 that you pay and what you charge the wholesaler is going to be based on a couple of things, like what kind of profit do you need to make to stay in business, but you also have to look at what a similar product is being sold for at retail. So in other words, if I want to sell bottled water, just because I couldn't find a good price at a factory doesn't mean I could charge whatever I want at retail so I could mark it up from my own price, and that's a problem.
And don't you have some retailers that are just want to push you down to the lowest price so they can be the low price person?
There are no retailers that ever want to make
hypothetically,
money.
Hypothetically, just throwing it out there.
Yeah,
there might be one.
They have to make money. I mean, and people have to understand this, that retailers are in business to make a profit. So your job, and it's good that they push people to get them lower prices, because it forces you to go to the factory.
Because now you got to go back to this manufacturer overseas and say, dude, you know, forget the dollar now. Now it's 70 cents or else we can't do, I'll lose my contract with the retailer, right?
And they know that, and that's true. The factories know that. So negotiating with the factory is commonplace. And look, the factory wants you to sell product, and if you don't make money, then you're not going to buy more product from them. So they get that. I mean, yeah, everybody wants to make a little extra money, but I don't think anybody's trying to really rip anybody off, because if there's a breakdown in the process where the manufacturer's charging too much, and then let's say Ron's got his product and he wants to charge the retailer too much because he wants to make a lot of money, and then the retailer charges way too much that people won't buy it.
Then it doesn't get sold, then no one makes
money. No one wins.
And the margins on products vary by industry. The one that I'm familiar with is the medical industry. Because one of my clients has a surgical device that his manufactured package cost from China to his doorstep here in Atlanta is 37 cents. And he sells it to the hospitals for $8. And then the hospitals sell it to the surgeons for $25. So the margins are just astronomical.
And that's why the healthcare system is where it is today.
Correct. Right.
They're not run by Walmart.
I'm not going there. We'll leave healthcare to the new presidential administration. Hopefully, we can get that all straightened out. But, you know, Ron's right. There are different profit margins. One that I think a lot of people can relate to is the gaming industry. So you buy an Xbox or a Wii.
Right.
There's really very little margin in the actual system itself. So you go out and buy a Wii, say, for, you know, $250. I mean, if they make 8-10 margin points, I mean, they make no money, literally, on the system.
So what's a margin point as a percentage?
Let's see how I could say this so it's understandable. A margin point is, in essence, half of what percentage is. So a 50 margin points is 100% markup. So if I sell Ron a product...
Well, give me the Wii. You said 8 to 10 margin points. What? How many dollars does that translate?
Yikes, I don't have a calculator out, but that's why I was going to use dollar and $2. So let's say I went to... I manufacture Wiis.
Right.
And they cost $1 for me to manufacture.
Okay.
If the retailer sells them for $2, and I'm just going off here on that... That's a 50-point margin, or doubling the money.
Right.
But that's 100% markup. But retailers usually talk in language of points, mm-hmm. not percentages that way. So when I approach them with a product, they'll say how many margin points are in it. I'll say, oh, it's a 40 margin point, 50 margin point, 60 margin point, and they can do the math on the percentages from there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because when you look at the razor handle and razor blade model,
right.
where they just give you the razor handle,
right.
and then they might not, they give it to you. They don't make any money on that at all, but they're counting on the fact that
you're going to be buying
their blades,
right.
and the margins on those blades is
right.
good. People like Wii and Xbox and all
or
like
cell
that.
Phones, that's the same thing. They're selling minutes, they're not selling phones.
Yeah, but a lot of device manufacturer companies will use that same model of, you know, here's your Xbox, here's your Wii, whatever, and they're really not making any money. Sometimes their model is that they lose money
they do.
On stuff like that
right.
because they know that long term when you're buying the things that go
games,
with it,
right.
the game, that's it's the game.
That's where they make the money.
Or printer cartridges, right? That's another.
Oh yeah, I got this really inexpensive laser printer, and I'm like, what a
you
great
thought
deal.
It was inexpensive.
I thought it was really great, but then the first time I had to replace cartridges, I'm like,
now I'm paying for that printer.
That's right.
Yeah, razor blades are that is definitely a great example. I mean, you see, but by the way, the razors aren't exactly cheap anymore.
I
got the razor for a buck and I had to pay, you know, $15 for a six pack of razors, I'd be happy. But I mean, these razors sometimes they're $8, $10, $12.
Right.
Yeah.
And then it's a huge investment just to shave. I'm like, man, you know, maybe I should just
and
throw
four,
a beard.
Five blades, six. You know, that's how they're changing.
Yeah.
But so that's one, I guess that's a whole business model when you have it, when you're manufacturing something where the product is kind of like a loss leader and then you're going to sell them the accessories to go along with it. But that's out of the norm, right, for most inventors?
Yeah, that's more of a, I don't want to say it's a sophisticated technique, but I think for most inventors, it should be basic. They have a product, they have to find a factory to make it correctly. Mm-hmm. And of course, you have to have all that safety testing. There's a lot of little components
right.
that go into it, but they just want to buy a product from a factory and sell that one product
sure.
for a profit.
So now, so they have their prototype. They I guess, where do they go? They go to the Yellow Pages to find a design firm? Like, where do you find these firms to build this to see if it can be manufactured efficiently?
Well, as Jim mentioned earlier, you know, the United Inventors Association is a good
place to start.
Right. Yeah. And go to a local inventor clubs. Usually there's prototypers that are members.
Uh-huh.
It's another place to start.
And it is good if you can use somebody local because, again, it's like anything. When I get to see people face-to-face, there's just that kind of connection. It's real to me. So,
but are there local resources in every market? I mean, like if you live in a small town in Iowa, there's going to be some guy?
Well, I mean, I don't know about – I think in most states and in near mid to large cities, there are resources.
There.
But, you know, you got to love the internet because at least if you live in a particular state in a small town – you can go on the internet and
find somebody
and Google,
by.
You know, that zip code. And there's almost always somebody within a reasonable distance. And even if they're 3-4 hours away, at least that's tangible. You could get to them if you had to get to them.
And the nice thing, you know, I saw a video clip, Jeff Bezos of Amazon, and he was saying that in a depression or recession, that's the best time to innovate. And that's true with prototypers because you know, business is down, they'll cut you a deal and do things less expensive than they would have when things were booming.
And factories, too. I mean, you're going on prototypers, but factories themselves...
They're hungry for business.
They,
right.
they have to. I mean, the Chinese factory machine really feeds off of volume. So if things are slow and you approach the right factory... It's time to negotiate hard for the best price.
Yeah. Now,
so for inventors, recessions are good because the cost of getting your product to market goes down.
Now, what these overseas manufacturers are, is the design firm that you contracted with to build your prototype, are they the connection to those? Or do you, again, as the inventor, have to approach these manufacturers?
Well, I mean, a good design firm or engineering firm will have at least one connection, but depends on what your product is.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to the right engineering firm, so let's say you make a cell phone.
Right.
If you find a firm that does not deal in cell phones or electronic products, they may not have a direct connection to a factory. But there are a lot of great factory brokers out there. I know a bunch of them myself that they will go out and they will find the right factory overseas. They will literally sometimes go make trips to China.
On your behalf?
On the client's behalf.
Right.
I mean, it's not free, but you know, if you just go online and try to find a factory, it's like the Wild West. You don't know what you're getting. So you have to work with factories. I mean, this is a critical component. Because
right.
If it's manufactured wrong, you get defects and it goes onto the store shelves and it's something wrong.
Right.
You know, game over.
Right. And there are trusted companies in China, believe it or not, regardless of what you hear. But what a lot of inventors will do, if they're really paranoid, and we always say there's only two kinds of inventors, paranoid and more paranoid, is they'll have some parts made in one factory, other parts made in another factory, other parts made in a third factory, then they'll have them assembled someplace else so that no one factory knows, you know, the secret sauce for their particular
invention.
Oh, so they
can't knock it off?
Right.
I'm not a big fan of somebody trying to go to multiple factories. And Ron said sometimes it's a trust factor. But
right.
If you can get one good factory who can manufacture your product, they'll get all the parts and pieces from other sources themselves. You'll let them do that. And a good factory will also be able to package your product. So in other words, you give them the order, and you get a finished product.
So you prefer a one-stop shop?
And that's ideal.
Yeah.
But what about the trust? A minute ago, the paranoid win. What's going on?
Look, I mean, Ron,
what's the level of paranoid should you be at this point?
Yeah, well, I think that's the thing. The level of paranoia, there should be no paranoia. I think you have to be smart and just be concerned about who you talk to and who you trust. But if you're working with trusted people, let's say you go to the UIA and you find trusted sources that have been proven to be safe for you to go to. Look, at some point you got to let go. You
it's
can't sell some
faith. You got to trust your advisors.
You can't
point,
sell
right?
something if you're going to hide it.
Right.
It just
can't
doesn't make
manufacture
sense.
It in your basement.
Right.
Yeah, because I tell folks that you know, when you get a patent here in the United States, that covers the United States, and they're like, "Well, I need a worldwide patent. I need to file in all these other countries." I'm like, "The United States is a huge market. You know, the patent that you're going to get is going to cover imports." Okay. And so if somebody in China makes your product and they ship it to the U.S. and you're making lots of money in the U.S. and then they also ship it to India and make some money, you know, let them live, you know.
Look, if this makes anybody...
Is that true? That you want to just give up, like, billions of people like that?
Well, the problem is, you know, do you have the resources, and most individual inventors don't, to file in the other countries and to enforce it in the other countries.
Right. So you just, I mean, the United States only 300 million people. I mean, there's billions of people in China and India.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just supposed to go, well, like my manufacturer can just go and sell my stuff there and that's okay?
Look, I could tell you from personal experience that in all the years I've been doing this, maybe I've seen one or two instances where somebody took a product, had it manufactured by a factory overseas, and that factory just went ahead blatantly and tried to sell it on their own. But factories, it's okay to let a factory sell your product overseas as long as you're getting paid for it. I mean,
right.
there are royalty situations where you could import the product in the United States and sell it, whether it's patented or not. But if the factory is going to sell it for you or wants to sell it in their market, say in China or India, hey, if you're getting a piece of the action,
yeah, no, I don't have a problem with that. But it's just like if they go, hey, you know, Uncle Sal, look at this product that I got, and then they flip it over to him, and he's like, yeah, we're going to blow this out in India.
Right. Yeah, and
it could happen.
You know, there's reality, and then there's perception of reality.
So is that a perception, or is that reality?
There's enough urban legend out there of people's ideas being stolen and made in China and sold worldwide, and them not getting a nickel. There's just one or two situations like that feeds, you know, the inventor paranoia. But the reality, like Jim was saying, is that the factories are there to make money, you know, and they want to have a relationship with you, and they don't want to mess up that relationship.
Right.
They don't want any kind of threat of lawsuits or, you know, you switching from them to somebody else. And so the reality is that, you know, companies can be trusted, even if they're in China, to make the product for you and deliver it to you in a quality way.
You know, it's like warning labels. My friend Jay and I talk about this all the time, where you see one of these labels on something and it'll say, you know, don't stick this thing in your ear or, you know, whatever. Right. And it's because somebody at some point did that,
right,
as ridiculous as it may sound. So while it's certainly not common, at least in my experience, to see, you know, Sal taking the product and saying, hey, let's go run with this. It happens, and it can happen, but it's not commonplace, and I think
right.
You can't be paranoid. You have to, again, it all comes down to working with people
trusted
who are
advisors,
in the business and
right.
trusted, and they'll make sure that at least the chance is just so minuscule that something like that could happen, but it can't be 100% prevented.
Right. To me, it's similar to the commercials you see on TV for all these medicines for ailments that you never knew existed.
Right.
And they have to, because I guess the FDA or FTC, they have to sit there and say, okay, if you got liver problems, don't take this. If you're pregnant, don't.
Right.
You know, it just goes through this whole list. And if you listen carefully to all the side effects that happens to one in a billion people, you're like, why would I want to take this medicine?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, why would I want to go out of the house? I mean, if I was afraid of everything right. I read, I wouldn't even be here right now. So,
right.
I mean, everything is about, like you said, Lee, it's about trusting people who have been down the road. They know what can happen, and they can at least try to guide you along the way.
Yeah, and the thing about prototypes is that you're going to go through several prototypes before you come up with the eventually what it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
We had one inventor come to us that had invented something called the stadium tray, and his first prototype was a FedEx box that he cut holes in, you know, just
right.
proof of concept. Luckily, he had a son-in-law that worked at a paper company, okay, and he went through 17 versions of this in order to get the thing sized right, the paper right, to where advertising could be printed on it and all like that, before he had finally came up with the one that he sold.
Mm-hmm.
17 versions.
Wow. So what is it? I mean, we've talked about different pricing things in previous shows, but what would be a prototyping cost range? Like if you're going to take your, I guess it's proof of concept is the first stage where you're kind of rigging something, and then now you're going to prototype it into something that can possibly be manufactured. Is this thousands of dollars?
It can be. I've had people call me and tell me they've gotten simple products that don't have a lot of moving parts or no moving parts done for a few hundred dollars. But to spend $1,000, $2,000, $5,000, that's common. If you have a professional firm
right.
do it. But it is worth the investment because, again, if you do it on your own, you think you've got it right, you send it overseas and you order 10,000 pieces from a factory and they come in and it's a, oops, this isn't working.
Yeah.
Guess how much that's going to cost you. So
right.
you got to get that right. And again, a good trusted firm is going to help you. You know, they brainstorm. They sit down with you in groups, and that's the process. So you go to a firm, a design firm or an engineering firm. They'll have their team sit around a table, and they'll
mm-hmm.
look at the product, and everybody will pick at it. And they'll ask the inventor questions and ask them how it's supposed to work. And then the engineers are going to put their engineer hats on and say, okay, they're going to find everything that could go wrong with it.
Right.
So this way, everything is right about it later. And then if you continue to work with that company, they can send that product over to a factory overseas. And they're going to send what people know as CAD, computer-aided design drawings, which is what a factory needs to actually make a product.
Mm-hmm.
And then the factory will give you quotes and all the pricing, and then you go from there.
Yep. And especially if you have a device that has to be made with a mold and, you know, stamped out in plastic.
Right.
Those molds in the United States will cost you a pretty penny. If you have the molds made overseas, the cost is a whole lot less.
Mm-hmm.
But people could spend $10,000, $50,000 on molds.
Well, yeah, I have a little mold strategy. Does that sound like a mold strategy? Yeah, just leave something mm-hmm. and it grow. A good strategy for inventors is when they get concerned about the mold or the tooling cost, the cost it takes to make the mold for their product, and often it's a plastic product. Those molds can be tens of thousands of dollars. Good factories will allow the inventor to basically recoup the cost of the mold. So, Lee, if you invent a new plastic bottle and it costs you $10,000 for the mold, you're like, man, that's a big check I got to write.
Right.
But you can ask the factory that after you sell 50,000 pieces or 100,000 pieces, if they will give you a credit towards the money you paid for the mold. So basically, it can cost you nothing. Now, not all factories will do that, but
right.
hey, I've had clients ask, and they received.
But that's another kind of validates the thought of having trusted advisors. They know what you don't know, so a regular person would never even know to ask that.
That's a great strategy.
You know, I think for me, I love helping people save money and prevent tragedies more than sometimes I actually like doing all these specific things for them, because that's what a lot of the what Ron calls inventive paranoia revolves around, is them losing their money.
Right.
So hey, if I could prevent you from losing your, I mean, I've seen people lose everything. So those things can be prevented.
Right.
Because I've got one client that she became a client as her product was being shipped in from China. So she had already gone through the process of, you know, having molds made, and it was an organizer for children's clothes. And it's the kind of thing that you'd see at the Container Store.
Right.
And, you know, I looked at it and I did the patent work for her and we sent it in. And we've got an allowance on the design patent, and we're still waiting on the utility. But she still has something like 6,000 of these in a warehouse, because as she's going through the process of trying to get some traction with different companies, nobody wants to deal with a one-product inventor.
Right.
Yeah, that,
that's another challenge. That sounds like another show.
That is that's an entirely another show. So
what would be the takeaways?
The wrap-up is when you have your product, and if you've gotten a prototype made, and of course you're going to have a prototype made somewhere, whether it's you try to do it yourself, you go to somewhere local, or you go to a very nice firm. Eventually, I think you need to go to a designer engineering firm professionally, pay the money to sit around in a brainstorm, have them review the product.
And poke holes in it. That's part of the review process.
That's
right?
It. Tear it down, tear it apart, and because they will know very specifically if the product can be efficiently manufactured, made at a price that's reasonable, that makes you competitive in the marketplace. And then from there, either they can source the factory for you, or there are, like I said, there are trusted sources through the UIA or even through Ron or I that we know that people can help you. There are brokers. Again, you'll pay a fee, but they will find legitimate factories who do this every day that are trusted that will make your product right.
Yep. And to add what Jim said, that the designer makes sure that it's optimized for manufacturing, for assembling, and for packaging.
Great. Good stuff, everybody. This is Lee for Launch, and thanks, Jim. Thanks, Ron. And we will see you next week.